This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. Today is May 12th, 2010, and tonight we are talking about teaching and learning and training and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, part of the reason I was thinking this was kind of interesting, I was just at this web camp thing in Toronto, and the format for it I thought was kind of cool. We had, like, first we did some basic like 101 stuff, and then we did a scenario where we kind of built an app through the day. And that's cool, but it's easy to just kind of sit and watch it and go like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And I've done that so many times when I've watched presentations or training. But then what I thought was kind of neat, James Sr. put this together, and he coordinated with these guys that do Startup Weekend. And with that, it's just all about building an app. So people get together, they'll pitch ideas, and they'll vote on ideas that seem interesting. And then people just get in groups and build something. And then at the end of the weekend, everyone's got all these cool apps, and they vote on who won, and people win prizes and may turn it into a product or whatever. So we kind of merged the two together. We had this guy, Nick Saguin, there who does these startup weekends. And so we did, you know, one day training followed by one day hackathon. And people who had like never built MVC apps or like actually won the prize at the end of the second day and built a pretty cool app. I thought that was interesting. I'm curious, like, what kind of things work well for you? Do you have any reaction to that?
Well, the hands-on stuff is great. I don't think that training on any particular topic just by lecturing and demonstrating things in front of people for 6 hours a day or 8 hours a day really does any good unless they actually sit down with Visual Studio open or whatever you're training on, sit down with the tool open and actually try to work things out for themselves. I think that's what really solidifies things for people and gets them ready to actually do production work with something.
Well, like one other example for myself, I definitely know, like, I'd seen plenty of presentations and read and followed blogs and stuff about Unity Framework, but my first project where I actually used it, then I ran into some interesting things where it's like, oh, wait a minute, I can't do that, or I need to think about this a different way, or that kind of thing. And I didn't really, you know, now I can say I actually understand generally, you know, I at least have working skills with it, where before, like, it didn't matter how much I'd seen and read and all that, I wasn't, you know, didn't have any real skill. I mean, I've convinced myself that I thought I had familiarity with it, but I didn't have any real working knowledge.
Yeah, it always kind of makes me wonder sometimes when, for like things like code camps where people will go for, or even a conference where people might show up for and go to 3 or 4 sessions during the day, and a lot of people come and they don't even bring a laptop to try anything out. I often wonder what they really get out of that investment of their time. They'll probably pick up some tips and tricks and go to work the next week and say, oh, I heard about this over the weekend, or I heard about this at the conference last week and it was kind of cool, but I'll have to play around with it some more before we can actually use it. You know, one person delivering content to a bunch of people. I think if you're sitting down to mentor or train someone that you're working with, then pair programming works the best.
Scott?
I think if you're mentoring or training someone, then you're not really pair programming per se, but you know, that's splitting a hair. Splitting that rabbit right down the middle. But as far as the people who go to code camps and don't really get much about it, I've never looked at code camps and at least the big conferences, I guess, I've never looked at as anything more than an opportunity to network and to, you know, share kind of ideas and stuff. And I've often thought that the code camps often leave out a doing, and as well as the big conferences, kind of a doing aspect of it. A lot of the RubyConf's conferences, and there's one in Oregon that started last year called OS Bridge. They actually organize hackathons where, you know, the entire point is, you know, you come, you bring your laptop and you write code with people. You pair up, you work alone, you do whatever, but you're writing code. And we had considered at Alt.net Seattle, we had considered having a kind of a doers session, where you actually, like, we had bounced around the idea of grabbing onto open source projects and saying, okay, you know, here are some bugs in StructureMap, here's some bugs in Fluent and Hibernate, here's some, you know, here's some documentation that needs to be written for FuboMC or for Fluent and Hibernate or whatever, and saying, okay, so we're gonna get together and we're gonna solve these particular problems that these open source apps have. That kind of fell through because we all have individual lives and things happen. And so we could never, you know, really organize it as much. But there's definitely some, there's an aspect of not really giving presentations at alt.net. You know, the open space concept, when you sit down, you just, you know, you put the code on the screen and you go through it. I think that's a key differentiator. And I think that's how people learn. Like until I actually got in and started using parts of MVC1, I didn't know where the pain really was. So it's hard for me to, you know, I get a pre-release version of ASP.NET MVC and they're like, okay, try it. And I'm like, well, I don't really have any real problems to solve with it. Now, I guess I'll just try making a hokey little site and we'll see how it works. And, you know, then when you don't have real deadlines and real world pressures driving you and real world requirements, you don't really see where the sharp edges are on some of these frameworks. And I think that's how you learn, you know, really the best. It's the same thing, you know, with lambdas or link or anything else. Until you sit down and actually write link code, you don't really get it. You don't see how, you know, lambdas can be used. I've never really liked the teachertainment kind of stuff that goes on at conferences, where, you know, the speaker is very entertaining and they're very funny and they do this kind of, you know, jazz hands razzmatazz and, you know, they show you different things, but, you know, they don't really teach you anything about it. They just show you, here's something I built with, you know, here's a piece of demoware I built with this new framework that's coming out. Those are kind of worthless to me, unless you just, you know, want to be entertained.
Well, sure. I mean, you said a lot of things that I thought were interesting. One, you know, the thing about the working and contributing to an open source thing. We did this thing a while ago. I've got my younger brother and a few friends here in town. We did this thing for a while when we actually had more time on weekends. We called it Hook a Brother Up. And we just take turns and we'd all go over and work at someone's house. And it's like we did this crazy, you know, stuff that like none of us would ever do on our own time because it would just take, you know, 10 hours. But you get like five guys together and it's done in four, you know, because you can just rip stuff down. And I mean, it's not like things go way faster than just multiplying it out, you know, and it's also like a huge, like it's fun, you know, working with people. So I think that kind of idea is great. I think that would be really cool to do in like a code camp or whatever kind of scenario. And, you know, also that just kind of reminds me of the whole like Google Summer Code and other things like that is a huge like adrenaline burst to these open source projects. And I wish we had more of that inside the Microsoft world.
Yeah, to me the key is the writing of the code. I mean, you know, I always find that I can look at code, as much code as I want. I can read all the books I want. But the first time I'll sit down and try to write something with some, you know, some framework I'm not familiar with, within a half an hour, I get stuck on something. And it's just until you actually, you know, put the pen to the paper, so to speak, there's going to be stuff that you're missing. And, you know, even the sort of canned labs that they give you in a lot of training, I have a problem with, because, you know, they put you on this very narrow path. You know, it's very easy to just sort of turn off your brain and type in what they're telling you. But until you've actually tried to solve a problem that is interesting to you and, you know, is sort of a real problem, I just don't think you get that much out of that kind of training. Or I don't anyway.
I think for me, the things that it does is maybe more like I guess it's reference kind of stuff where you can, you know, I'll watch something and I'll say, okay, that's generally how you do that. And then I'll go back and watch it, or, you know, it's something that you can refer to later. But I think also a lot of what it does is more just kind of make it like remind me that something's out there and kind of give me a little comfort, like, okay, that doesn't look that bad. I could probably do that, you know? And then like, it's more of, I guess, like an advertisement to, you know, get me to go out and try something rather than, you know, for instance, I've been catching up on some of the mixed presentations I hadn't seen. And one guy that I just love watching is Robbie Ingebretson. And he does these great presentations on just design stuff. And like immediately it was like, well, okay, I'm want to do more of this in all my work, you know, not just, you know, visual design, but just, so, I mean, I guess some of it's just like inspiration and kind of like making me feel like, yeah, this is something I need to bring into my work. But yeah, the exact technical details almost never are as simple as it, because you can't, you know, like I think it'd be most presentations would be just completely boring if you tried to get every single edge case. I'm curious, Kay Scott, like what kind of, when you do training with Pluralsight, what, I mean, if you can or want to talk about that, like how that, you know, like what you're able to do with that in order to engage people and stuff.
Well, it's a combination of presentations and lots of coding demos, and then also lab time, hack time, you know, try to, the thing about Pluralsight instructors is we try to be experts on a topic. And typically when you get called into a company to train on something, it's because they do have an interesting problem to solve already. They have a project coming up that they have to work on. So they have some idea of what they need from that training to achieve their goals. And they're going to have specific questions about architecture or patterns or how to do this with that. And so it's usually pretty interesting. I mean, it's when someone has a problem to solve, they usually start coming up with some interesting questions during a class. So it's always kind of fun to wind up in a situation where you just start working together with people to solve their problems. At the same time, you're doing these presentations, which tell them, you know, why something was designed this way and how it's supposed to work. And now here's how you can apply it to your specific situation. And to me, that's just one of the advantages of having someone come in to do training that knows the topic really well and works with a team of people that are all working towards the same goal, as opposed to going to a conference or something and being in a room with 30 to 300 people who are going to ask random questions that you don't care about.
Yeah, so it's kind of consulting and training mixed together.
Yeah, I'd say so.
That was something interesting that I saw at this web camp, was some people just had ideas of things that they'd always wanted to build or something that just kind of struck them. But then there were other people where they'd have four people from a healthcare company and they'd say, this, you know, we have this thing that always bugs us and we're just going to fix it. Like, we've got four people together. We've got the day Saturday. Nobody's going to tell us what to do. We're just going to, you know, take the time and fix this annoying problem. I thought that was really pretty cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
So, John, you recently, as of today, in fact, released, or at least published, publicly announced the ASP.NET MVC music store sample. And, of course, you're taking lots of criticism because that's what people do with MVC sample projects. They give lots of unnecessary criticism around the design of the sample.
Tough love.
yes, that's it. They give lots of tough love. But so I'm wondering if there's a wider gap between kind of marketing or introducing people to something and actually teaching them. Because I started to think that maybe some of the big problems that I have with the larger conferences, the tech eds, the PDCs, and some other kind of vendor conferences like that, is that they're actually more marketing conferences than they are technical. And maybe I'm expecting too much out of my, you know, 45 or an hour that I'm there. Like they used to, I don't know, maybe they don't do this anymore. They used to label things as like 100, 200, 400 level in terms of the presentation that's going to be given. So, you know, so you could kind of gauge how technical or what level of knowledge you had to have. You know, is this undergraduate course on Silverlight, or is this the graduate level, or is this the postdoc? You know, that kind of stuff. So I was curious what's your... Like, well, you and K-Scott have probably designed sample apps before, you know, to showcase new technologies or to do technologies. No, John has. So I was kind of wondering what your goals are. Do you care about advanced or maybe even not so much advanced but necessary kind of design patterns, for lack of a better word, or, you know, architecture concerns? Or is your main goal to kind of give the... You know, here's kind of what a controller does. Here's kind of what, you know, here's what a view model is in Silverlight. Here's what the little dollar sign means in front of all those parentheses in your jQuery code. That kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. Well, so yeah, a few things. One was the, you started by talking about the conferences and how, you know, it's more kind of marketing-y and stuff like that. And I think sometimes that's true. I thought, like, for instance, with Mix, they did have some kind of more advanced applied things, and they brought in people, you know, people signed up and voted on these talks. Like, for instance, Laurent Bunion spoke about the MVVM pattern and kind of went a little deeper on it. And Nate Kahari talked about something to do with Agile Zen, some kind of, but it was more kind of like advanced design stuff. So anyhow, I do think that there is some of that, but I think a lot of time people expect to see kind of like an overview of a new technology. Like, for instance, I think probably some of the biggest attended talks at Mix were like, what's new with Windows 7 Phone and what can you do with Windows 7 Phone? So I don't know. It may be kind of reaction to that. I definitely, you know, I don't schedule any of that. I don't know. But I mean, I'm just kind of guessing there. But the other part of what you were saying was about how, you know, how do you write tutorial or content, or like, and so I think probably for me, the biggest thing that I've learned, I did put disclaimers on the one that I was writing that's like, this is for beginners only. This is an introduction. This is how to learn the mechanics of how it works, you know. But I think I maybe should have put more in just saying, you know, this is not, you know, production ready app, you know, that kind of stuff. I think people probably could have told that if, you know, that like the shopping cart doesn't actually accept any payment, you know, and the admin system only edits one table in the entire database and stuff. But I think like, I think that you can only do so much in anything. Like you can't teach 101 and 400 level content anywhere. And so I think it gets difficult. Like you don't want to do, you don't want to teach anti-patterns, but you don't, you have to focus on something. Like you can't do everything all at once. And I don't know. That's my thought. I'm definitely not sure. Like I'm just, but my thinking is that like I did when I worked through this sample with people this past weekend, I worked with people that really wanted to learn it. And I spent time with them and we worked through parts of it. And there's, it, they just weren't at a spot where if it had had dependency injection and required, you know, understanding of testing and mocking and that kind of stuff, that they would have, like, they would have done nothing. They would have gotten past step maybe 1.5 that day, you know? And so I feel like for different things, sometimes you have to just understand the, you have to understand even like, what is MVC? How does it work? How can I get Hello World onto the screen? And then now I can start like putting some design patterns and software practices behind it and stuff like that. Like, you know, for the same reason, you can't really do source control until you have some source, you know, and it's an important practice, but you like, you don't start, I don't know. I don't think you start by like, here's all the practices and now let's write Hello World. I don't know if that works. What do you guys think?
Finding that focus is definitely a tough balance. In fact, I think it's the hardest part of any instructional piece of work that you put together, whether it's an article or a sample application or a video. You have to find that area that you want to focus on for 20 minutes or 1 hour or 3,000 words. And like John said, you don't want to lead people in a direction that they would go down the wrong path or follow anti-patterns. But at the same time, you might not be able to go into things like mocking frameworks and the subtleties of interaction testing versus state-based testing. You just can't do that. I mean, I was kind of struggling that with that recently on a white paper I was doing for Microsoft on unit testing and testability of code that uses the entity framework. And it was interesting because, you know, I wanted to show how you could use a mocking framework, show how you can write repositories and with POCO classes and not have to worry about any of that code-generated stuff that the entity framework spits out. But at the same time, there's, you know, not enough time to go into a lot of the subtle details or explain how to use dependency injection and all that other stuff that's sort of on the periphery. So you either have to assume that someone already knows that stuff and they're coming to this paper to see the basics of how they can apply all these things they know using this framework, or, you know, the people that don't know that, well, they're going to learn it eventually. You just try not to confuse the issue in your material. It's tough.
Yeah, I think probably the biggest mistakes that I've made several times so far is not clarifying like this is a 101 level course, or this is going to assume you have some background here, or that, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And clarifying what you're doing first, and then at the end probably wrapping up and saying like, we've covered the basics, your next step is to go here and figure this out, and you know, like you're not done when you've learned this. Like give context,
I guess. I don't remember who I was talking to recently, but they were saying, yeah, I was trying to learn MVC and I pulled down that Nerd Dinner sample. And I'm thinking, well, that's a good start. That's a really simple application. It's only got a couple tables. It's very simple. Simple, right? And this person's like, but, you know, I open up this Nerd Dinner application. It's got all these new things in there. It's using entity framework or these link statements. He's got these, you know, weird new anonymous type things. They didn't even know what the anonymous types were in the code, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it. And that's when you think, well, yeah, sometimes you really have to understand who's trying to, or you just have to know what audience you're targeting.
I do get that it's a fine balancing act for sure, and definitely introducing things like IOC, although it would be nice if they were baked in the framework, you know, they're not. And so leading off with that could definitely be overwhelming to somebody. I do think unit tests, however, are always a good thing to include in any kind of project like that, both from a teaching best practices approach, you know, kind of thing, and also just because you know, a well-constructed unit test can help explain what the code is doing. So, John, if I had to give you one bit of grief, I think it would be around that.
Yeah. You know, and I'm shocked. I was not expecting to hear that from anyone. No, actually, I think it was kind of painful to write. Yeah, it's definitely something that was painful to publish that way. And I'm kind of planning on like adding other things and probably at least have like a unit test project that you can download and look at as well. I agree. I think that tests definitely can help explain the code as well as just show, like, it does make a statement. There's tests here and that shows that, yes, these tests are important and, you know, you may not need to understand everything about them, but they're an important thing you should know about.
Well, so as far as the including a unit test project, I mean, you know, even if you include one, they're still going to criticize you on, you know, what you're testing or how you're testing. And, you know, they're going to say, well, you know, this isn't the proper unit test and this isn't coverage. And, you know, you've only got X number of unit tests or, you know, and it doesn't cover this. And, or, you know, this is stupid. You don't have to write this test. So, you know, as far as general acceptance from the community, you can't really win when you decide to put sample code out there. So I'm wondering if there's too much emphasis on frameworks and products and maybe what am I trying to say? So most of the time people when they look at stuff like NerdDinner or they look at other projects, you know, they look at all the lambdas, they look at the generics, they look at anonymous types, and they just get confused because they haven't had to do that stuff yet because wherever they're working is still stuck on .NET 2.0 because they can't convince the system administrators to install .NET 3.5 or anything later on their systems until it's passed some sort of rigorous, mythical, you know, testing to make sure it's not going to crash all the apps on their system, which, you know, of course, they can't actually do because their apps don't run on any other systems except the production ones because they can't get them to run anywhere but there. But I may be ranting a little bit. And so I'm wondering if there needs to be more, instead of talking so much about the framework, maybe we should talk about some of the things that are done inside of the methods, like between the brackets. Like, you know, what is that stupid looking parentheses with the arrow next to it? What is that doing? You know, what does that really mean? What is a lambda? That sounds complicated. And, you know, and kind of discuss that. And I think they kind of did when they were first introduced, when lambdas and anonymous delegates and things like that were introduced. But they talked about them in the abstract and then talked about them in the context of a project or a framework, you know. Here's how you could do it not using a lambda, but when you use a lambda, look, it goes down to, you know, two lines. Or here's how you could do it, you know, doing an old for over the array, but here's how you do it, you know, using link with a lambda. And, you know, just showing that kind of distinction, even if it means, you know, putting a big giant comment in there saying, you know, here's what this method would look like if we didn't use a lambda here, you know, and showing the 10 lines of code that you got spilling over everywhere. Especially if it's going to be a sample app and you're going to use newer language features, maybe you need to include those kinds of comments and that kind of, you know, side-by-side comparison within the methods.
Yeah. And, you know, I did a tiny bit of that in my project, like when I was saying, here's a strongly typed helper and this is using a lambda expression and this is kind of what it does. And, you know, just kind of in passing talk a little bit about it. It's a little bit tricky with that too, because there's, like you're saying, there's a range in, you know, whatever knowledge of different things, but there's also like this huge time delay of like early adopters, MVPs, bloggers, all these people are all our friends listening to this podcast are digging into things way ahead of time in the alphas and betas and stuff. And they're already bored with it when it ships. And then you've got this long kind of whatever tail thing of when people are actually using something. And then, so then you almost feel like, is this insulting or stupid to like explain what a lambda expression is? But then, you know, it's been out for years. I think one of the weirdest places with this is WPF, because people are still learning things in WPF that were out, like, I don't know. I mean, people were blogging about them like since, what, 2004 or something. So it's like this weird long time delay thing of like, how long do you keep explaining things? It's hard to know.
Speaking of WPF, you know what annoys me about XAML-based samples is that sometimes you just want to look up how to do a list box inside a stack panel, blah, 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 and you find the perfect sample that illustrates your point, but you have to dig through whoever made this sample. that was trying to make just that point also had to make it really pretty and include like 500 lines of unrelated XAML to set styles and colors and actually make things look pretty if you make it run. I don't know, that's just something that I've run into a couple times over the years. But going back to Scott's point about explaining some of the whys and doing some comparisons and sample apps, I think that's a pretty cool idea. I mean, one of the things I like to do when I teach technology is try to find whys. Like for Lambda expressions, why did the C# team even consider this feature? How did it end up in the language? And now that it's there, why would I care about it? What kind of problems can you solve with it? And then how can I think about it, not only the implementation details, like what does this actually do, but how can I take a couple steps back and get some more perspective and maybe think about functional programming and just the types of problems it solves and how it's really useful to separate and make a distinction in your code between deciding to do something and actually doing something, right? And you see that everywhere. So people that write jQuery and people that write link queries with extension methods, they see that all the time.
I totally agree that like reading things in context, seeing things in context makes them make a lot more sense. Like you can read about, I remember reading about all these things and you know, what is a Lambda expression? That's great. But until you actually see it in context and go, okay, that makes sense. You know, then that's when I started really using them in code. And one place I've been thinking this lately is I've been looking at the MVC source code just to make sure I understood everything and really kind of digging into it. And I like that it's pretty well commented in places where it'll say, we could have done this, but that causes this problem here, so we did this instead. Or, you know, this method is just required for compliance with this or that kind of thing. And so I think that's pretty effective, the whole context, like whether it's in an article or training or you know, actually reading some source.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to be able to look at all the FX cop suppression attributes that are stickered all over the MVC source and find out what's really going on under there. But yeah, it's the same thing in all languages. Once you get past kind of the standard if else and, you know, the kind of basic C structures that people learned, or C syntax, if else and for loops and things like that, when you get into, you know, even in Ruby and JavaScript and metaprogramming and you know, blocks and things like that. And yeah, people say, I don't understand all that. That's too complicated. I am but a simple, unfrozen caveman programmer. Your mathematical constructs confuse and frighten me. And yeah, at some point, yeah, this stuff has been out since 2004. It's time to, you know, buck up and put on your big boy panties and learn it.
I have to say that one of the things that it always strikes me when you know, whenever you have these samples and the samples are overly simplified because, you know, they don't want to get bogged down in the details or lost in the details. Ultimately, it always kind of niggles at me. Like, is the fact that, you know, that is always a concern mean that we're just doing something wrong? There's something wrong with our frameworks. There's something wrong with our languages that is, you know, that in order to do something real, it has to get really complicated. Like, for example, I mean, obviously I'm still a total Ruby Rails noob, but, you know, and I look at sample code in Rails, and it's, I mean, not sample code, I look at real code, like real open source projects, and the real code doesn't look that complicated. You know what I mean? It's not like when you went from sample to real, it got a lot more complex. And that just tells me that there's something sort of fundamentally different about that framework, about, you know, the whatever it is, the malleability of the Ruby language, the Rails framework. I'm not exactly sure yet, but there's just something different about it that doesn't lead you down this path of complexity in order to do something real. I don't know. What do you guys think? Am I totally off my rocker here?
Is it that it constrains the problem to an area where you're not, you know, making a huge amount of choices?
I don't know. I mean, they're solving complicated problems in a very real way. I mean, it's not like these are simplistic solutions. They're genuine applications. You know, you go look at Shapato. It's the Stack Overflow engine written in Ruby. I mean, it's not a dumbed down sample. But and yet, it somehow seems to be much terser, much less, you know, ceremony is the standard word people use. It feels like, you know, in the .NET world, we're sort of missing something.
So take Fubo MVC, for example. You follow Jeremy Miller's blog, you look at what he talks about on Twitter, and you look at Structure Map and kind of see where his thoughts are and his team's thoughts, and you think, my God, there's no way I'm going to understand FUBU MVC if I look at the source code. It's just going to be too complicated. They've been doing all these little tricks and little clever hacks and things in there to get things to go just their way. But then you look at it, and like every method is like two or three lines. And, you know, the worst you have to do is go to definition to keep kind of going. And if you're using, you know, ReSharper or CodeRush, you're just hitting a function key or a control key combination to go to the definition to see what's happening and understand the code. And they're all very small. And it's nothing very complicated. It's just very decoupled. And, you know, it's actually easier to read than some of these sample things that are, you know, 20 or 30 lines where they've kept it simple. You know, because they don't want to get lost in the details. And so there is kind of it's possible to do simple and easy to understand C# code. But I do think that a lot of the ceremony of C# and the .NET framework gets in the way. On the other hand, there's far less underscores in C# code than there is in Ruby code. I can tell you that for a fact.
Well, I was going to say, if you took out all of the generics, the generic type parameters, the generic constraints, and the interface definitions, none of which you would need in a language like Ruby, FUBU MVC would look even simpler. I still debate in my mind which is better, though.
I'm curious, too. That brought up the other thing of like, well, so there's these kind of simple applications, and then people say, well, can you do something more real world? Can you show, you know, like, how about a sample that's kind of more, you know, extensive, not so simplified down. And then, but then at that point, you're bringing in, like, any real world app has a bunch of dependencies, does get more complex, runs into these kind of side things. And then at that point, I almost feel like, well, the answer, if you want something like that, is to look at a real open source app, of which there are a good amount out there. But I'm curious if you think that that's, I don't know, how you would solve that problem, or what kind of samples would address something that are kind of more complex.
Well, it's really hard to do it outside of the context of a specific real-world scenario. I mean, you can write code and someone would say, okay, you did that for a sample, but what would it look like in the real world? And, you know, I don't know what your real world looks like. I don't know if you're trying to write something that's highly available or highly scalable, or if all you care about is testability and getting it to work in a continuous integration build, or, you know, what is your real world? Do you have to audit things? Do you have to be HIPAA compliant? It's a big world out there. You have to pick the real world context for something specific, right?
Yes.
All right. So here's a question for everybody. I think this is something that I was thinking about a lot, like a year ago, 6 months ago. I was trying to decide how do new people learn. Like, I think the original question at the beginning was how to train relative newbies. And I used to think that videos weren't that great. Like if I right now would sit down to watch an MVC presentation or a video on ASP.NET MVC, it would be really tedious. And I'd want to do it at like 3x speed just to get through it as quick as possible. But when it comes to something that I'm completely unfamiliar with, like if I want to learn a little bit about Android development, I find any sort of video really interesting, not just because I can learn some of the tools and here's the commands and this and that, but I also figure out what little tips people do and, oh, how'd they do that? Let's figure out what keyboard shortcut they just used, or I didn't know about that tool. So I was just kind of curious, maybe this is like a mini lightning round. If you guys are learning a new technology, do you prefer a presentation or a video or just a book? Like, before you even try to write that first line of code with it, what would be the first thing you do, John?
Ah, okay. Yeah, I like video for a first introductory thing, almost kind of like a tourist, like welcome to our country kind of thing. So I like that for basic familiarity, just get an idea, even like you're saying, what tools to use, what's important, where do I get started? And then after that, I get really upset at videos because they're totally annoying. Like, once I have familiarity in an environment, it's frustrating to try and look up documentation that's in video format for me. I want text at that point. Usually not a book, but, you know, usually it's Bingle or whatever. You know, Stack Overflow, go and find the answers there. Yes.
What about Kevin?
Generally, video has not worked that well for me personally, mostly because I tend to try to learn in small chunks. I don't have like an hour to sit and watch an extended video. So being able to kind of, you know, find the time wherever and wherever I am, you know, with video, like I have to either sit and watch it in one place, or I have to know that I was at minute 42 of this particular video. And unless I can dedicate a lot of time, like for example, if I'm sitting on an airplane, you know, I can do that. But other than that, I really like the kind of scannability of text and the ability to just kind of go back and forth to it.
So maybe buy a book. You were trying to
I used to do more books than I do now. I find even now, you know, now that I have a family and stuff, finding time to sit down and read a big book is even hard. But I still do it. I mean, I don't avoid it at all costs. But you know, so I learn a lot more from some just blogs and posts and articles and things these days than I think I used to be. I would have gotten a book, but less of that now.
What about Scott K?
I generally kind of like to read a book a little bit. I use the book as a reference when I'm doing something with the code. So, like a lot of times with C# or JavaScript, I'll just start writing, and I don't really care if it's correct or if it's the best practice or whatever. And then when I reach some point where I'm like, well, how do I do that? Or, you know, I know I can do it this way. Is there a better way to do it within the language of the framework? Then I'll pull out a book. So I tend to keep a lot of those little O'Reilly pocket references on hand, and I tend to grab ebooks and store them in my Dropbox so that I have them on all the computers that I'm using. So if I ever get stuck, I just have to open up the ebook and search through a PDF to find out the answer or find out how to do something. But yeah, it's basically a combination of doing and using books as references. And of course, Google as a reference.
Awesome.
Did you want a lightning round? Anything else?
I didn't prepare.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
Probably close enough on time.
You can
anyhow.
Dock my pay. Hey, but you know what? When I was in Holland like a month ago, I was in the back of a taxi and we drove by this really nice looking estate. And the taxi driver says that is where Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, that's one of her like summer homes or something.
Wow.
I was like, she sponsors my podcast.
You popped in to say hello, did you?
And he's like, what?
She did say stop in any time, I'm pretty sure. I can't remember. The show was a while back. Well, that's awesome. And on that note, we should probably wrap up.
Actually, wait, maybe one more comment about the video thing. Because one of the features that Rob has talked about adding to TechPub is a video bookmark. So basically you can watch a video on one machine, pause it, and then, you know, come back to it later and it will remember where you were on any machine. That sort of thing would make video, you know, more palatable to me, or more practical, I guess. Not palatable is the right word. Where I can just kind of hop around wherever I'm at and you know, watch a few minutes here, a few minutes there. Okay, that's it.
I totally agree. I think if you're watching video, things like that totally make a difference, especially if you're watching a lot of them. There's you know, the bookmarking, there's being able to jump to a time. There's I very frequently, like, even if something's available in a nice pretty player, I'll download it so that I can watch it at 1.5 speed or 1.2 speed even, you know, and can, you know, make it full screen without having the chrome of the video all around it and that kind of thing. So I think if I am, you know, stuck with watching video for a while, that all those kind of things are important. There, we made it through to the birds.
Oh, it's been a while.
Well, we're talking about video, any thoughts? Like, one thing that I had noticed recently is that several, like VLC, and I noticed a Hulu player, and I think some others had kind of, I've seen these standard, you know, space bar is start and stop because it's the biggest button. You just whack it and there you go. And then I think, I know VLC has this F for full screen, you know, toggle full screen, and then control up and down arrow for volume up, down, control left and right for skip forward and back. And I just love those like very simple, intuitive keyboard commands. And I wish those were like standard on all video players. I hope that we don't end up with everybody, you know, Firefox has, you know, their HTML5 video player skipper controls, and everybody has different ones for Flash and Silverlight, and we have different ones for, I don't know. It'd be nice if we get something kind of standard and not a keyboard button. That's a big play.
There's a simple solution to this. You just have one browser that controls the world.
Opera.
Not according to Joe Hewitt. You have a different browser for every app you want to run.
All right, we don't have time to go into that now.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Tune in next time.
Yes, exactly. And on that note, yes, tune in next week for something else.